Welcome, welcome, welcome. How's everybody doing? Hope you are doing well. My name is Andrew Kuhn with Focus Compounding, on air live with Jeff Cannon. Jeff, how's it going today?
It's going very well, Andrew. How's it going with you?
It's going great. We hope it's going great with everybody else as well. If this is the first time you are tuning in with us, thank you so much for joining us. Be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. The best way to do that is to follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Focused Compound. All of the information is in the description below. If you want to get access to investment write-ups from Jeff on basically any investing topic that you can think of, go to FocusedCompound.com. It's all free. You could search your topic in the search bar, and you'll get a bunch of blog posts on that topic going all the way back to 2005. So before I clicked record, we were talking about Reddit. Reddit is up 37% currently. They IPO'd today. Today is March 21st. And you were telling me that you were surprised that they waited so long to go public. It seems like you think about them like the same era as Twitter. And you're also saying that they've also never really made money. So what's your thoughts on Reddit?
I mean, I was surprised that they'd never gone public like before the pandemic and stuff. Yeah, not that they've waited till now, because as I think we've talked about a little bit on the podcast, only recently has it really been possible to do IPOs again. Mm-hmm. And most of those are in like the really hot stuff, the AI things and all that kind of related stuff. Not so much in older technology things like this, where we're going back to mm-hmm. the stuff that was popular, what, a decade and a half ago. This would have been the hot stuff for people to be interested in, would have been when social media stuff was going public. So, but yeah, I was surprised to think that they had never gone public in the past. But
do you use Reddit?
No, I mean, I've used Reddit because it does sometimes have the best answer for something that I've searched.
Yeah,
but mm-hmm. that only accidentally from ending up on it. Yeah,
I'll use it sometimes. Like I'll just. I don't know, healthy gluten-free meals Reddit, and then I'll just like pull up a bunch of different threads just to see, get conversations from people in the past, just to be able to kind of browse through there. I didn't really even start to use Reddit though to a few years ago, like as a research tool, you know, for whatever. Mm-hmm. They definitely have a lot of, it is a huge, I don't want to call it an expert network. That may be a little too ambitious, but a people network, you know? Like, it's funny because everyone's anonymous, you know? So you think about what it is versus like a Facebook or Twitter, where Facebook, mm-hmm. you don't really get really any anonymous people unless they're fake accounts. Then Twitter, you get sort of half and half. And then Reddit is completely the other way, where it's like basically everybody's anonymous unless it's, you know, somebody doing like an AMA on there because they want to have their name be out there. But
yeah, it basically ends up working like a Wikipedia, same thing. Yeah. It's about as reliable and about as anonymous and everything. Yeah, we'll see how they plan to make money and stuff. I don't know how brand safe and stuff it'll be for advertising and everything, but that was always an issue with Twitter too. So
yeah, interesting. So at today's podcast, Jeff, on our last podcast, you had briefly mentioned looking for ideas like through stocks that have emerged from bankruptcy. So Bill Ackman was recently on Lex Fridman's podcast, and he talked about his investment in General Growth, which was a company that they bought out of bankruptcy. It was probably one of the best returns his fund Pershing Square ever had. I don't know if they made like 70 times their money, something crazy. They bought it basically as like a $20 million company. In bankruptcy, or $30 million company, a microcap that post-bankruptcy, post-Chapter 11, came out and was worth, you know, billions of dollars. And Lex Fridman had asked him about how did he learn about bankruptcy investing, and Bill Ackman said this book right here, which you have probably don't have in front of you because I just got it delivered today. It's called Bankruptcy Investing, How to Profit from Distressed Companies by Ben Branch and Hugh Ray. So Bill Ackman recommended this book, and I ordered it. I think the price has gone up a little bit since the Lex Fridman podcast has aired. Just came in today, so I'm going to read it. But I did want to talk about stocks emerging from bankruptcy, stocks that do go into bankruptcy. When we first launched Focused Compounding, the managed accounts on our presentation, we put bullet points of sources of ideas, spinoffs, illiquid stocks, microcaps, and stocks emerging from bankruptcy was on there. So I wanted just to talk a little bit about it, why you think that's an interesting place for people to look for value. Spinoffs are so picked over nowadays, and I'm sure, you know, there's cycles to these things. And I'm sure one day spinoffs will become a great hunting ground for investors. But I do still think stocks that emerge from bankruptcy, stocks that go into bankruptcy, Chapter 11, could be an interesting place to look for value. And I've written about it privately before, how I think it's, if an overall industry goes through a downturn that ultimately leads to Chapter 11s, it could be a great source or a good hunting ground to look for value, because whoever makes it to the other side, you know, could come out better and stronger. They probably equitize their debt, or they recapitalize their debt structure. They may limit or get rid of interest expenses. But really, from a supply perspective, if a whole industry goes through a downturn that leads to bankruptcies, the people that make it out on the other side, it may be less competitive. Wanted just to get your general thoughts on it as a place to look for value. The hardest part with these sort of themes is just aggregating all the data and keeping up with everything, you know? Mm-hmm. There's a monitor that we have used before called TofCap. On Substack, shout out to them. They're also on X, and they track, you know, different event-driven stuff. But yeah, just wanted to get your thought on, you know, stocks emerging from bankruptcy as a place to look for interesting investment ideas.
Yeah, so we haven't done a lot in that area, I would say, because the same issue of spinoffs and stuff, I think that it's been, like you said, picked over and whatever. Just because we haven't had a lot of tight financial conditions for very long or something. As you said, though, it's when a bunch of companies in the same industry go under that sometimes can be helpful, because then you get a lot of that. And the issues with it are, it depends on what you're looking for, right? So there's a lot of different reasons why a company could end up in bankruptcy. The best would be that it's a fundamentally good business and stuff, but it was structured wrong. And now that structure is not going to continue, right? Or it could be that it was some one-off thing with, like, the pandemic. That's possible, right? So in recent memory, the pandemic is the thing that would be the most possible. The problem is, a lot of times when they talk about a one-off thing, it is not a one-off thing. What they're actually talking about is a cyclical industry where everyone will go bankrupt every 20 years or so. And so some of the examples that you gave, while great examples, it's not illogical that they would go bankrupt, because they required a lot of debt to finance things. And then there's a point in the cycle where things like ships, rigs, there's other things we could think of, are basically worthless on a spot basis. You know what I mean? So if they're under contract for long periods of time, they would still be under contract and everything. But you hit that point where if they're not being utilized right now, no one wants to pay a day rate or whatever for it, because there's just no demand in the industry, because the industry does get to a point where there's just no demand. You know, we looked at a company at one time, wasn't it something coming out of bankruptcy, but it was something that did stuff in CapEx for shipyards. And one thing to keep in mind is that the bottom of the cycle for CapEx for shipyards is nothing, because you can defer on ships. You can defer even longer on a shipyard. You can really defer on that stuff. So it does get down to zero. We talked about that a little bit with, I think, Somero Enterprises is another good example of something with that kind of cyclicality. Good business, but highly cyclical. At some point, people just will not buy something to level, cement and stuff for warehouses and all that, right? Like the it's so cyclical, it's so far up there. Another one would be like, what are those? There's some companies that make like tires for equipment used in mining and stuff, right? So that's in the same category as those sorts of things, where it's extremely long cycle and there's some point in the cycle where you will get no orders. And if you have debt and no orders, then you can go bankrupt. And so, we've talked about a bunch of companies that people were interested in as spinoffs or whatever, and then they end up in bankruptcy. So it's another thing to follow also how things end up in bankruptcy in the first place. And I would say most of these fall in the category of Ben Graham type investments. Maybe you're invested for 3 to 5 years. Or Warren Buffett, you could say the net-net idea, which is, I always say, you know, he has a great quote on that, that there'll be some hiccup and that's how you'll make money. And that's what it is, that something will happen. And so the industry will look good for a second and then you'll sell out, but not that you'd expect to own it forever. So I know one that we did mention before was California Resources went through bankruptcy, and there are also warrants on that one and stuff. And that was good because if ever oil got a little more interesting in terms of the price, then you would could make money on it. But it wasn't something that you had to stay in for the long term. And so all you're expecting, all you're betting against is that oil wouldn't stay low and not volatile in price for a long time. All you needed was a bunch of volatility or a stronger average price over time. Either one would probably do. So that's a good example of something that I think would make sense as a bankruptcy, something that you buy coming out of bankruptcy, but maybe not something that you'd always want to own forever.
Mm-hmm. Do you think investing, I mean, do you generally try to stay away from cyclical companies? Is that, I mean, I know we have exposure to energy and we spoke about that in our last podcast, how we're definitely over indexed to it, but are you turned off by cyclical companies?
No, I'm not necessarily turned off by cyclical companies. One, cyclical companies deserve a lower price than non-cyclical companies because they are not created equal at all. And even though people do that, you can look at 100 years of data or longer and see that if you're making alcohol, tobacco, media stuff, whatever, you have better returns over your entire lifetime than you do if you're coal and shipping. And it's not an accident. Cyclicality is an error in human thinking that causes it. It is not something that just should be a natural feature of it. Otherwise, if people were that good at speculating, the fact that it's a very long cycle shouldn't still be a problem. They should be able to figure out, you know, even if it's the asset has a 20-year life or something, they should still be able to figure out this and not cause that kind of cyclicality. So as a result, cyclicals generally have worse returns. Some of the only cyclicals that have really good returns over very long periods of time are financial engineering and capital allocation by the people in charge. So it's a great place for people to use their capital allocation skills, use their value investing skills. And in a bunch of places in the world, not so much the United States, that is what value investors do. They're heavily into cyclical things, buying at the bottom, selling at the top, all that. Generally what people ask about cyclicals is when they're doing well. And so I sound very negative on them because of the higher prices and stuff now. Whereas when they're most exciting usually is when the price is low and not very volatile. So when people are interested in it is when it's very volatile or, you know, lime is not terribly cyclical. Volume is pretty cyclical in the lime industry, though, but price is not cyclical at all. And so when I was talking about U.S. lime, it was before there was the big inflation thing there, right?
Yeah.
When we were talking about NACO in the beginning, it was before there was a big increase in the gas prices, right? Now gas prices are low again. So the way that I would look at a cyclical is I like it when the a way that I do it a lot of times is think in terms of a formula and what are the different things that are, and are they high or low, right? So what are the different inputs they need in terms of, is volume now high or lower than it would normally be? Is price now higher or lower than it would normally be? Is the multiple on it higher or lower than it would normally be? And as many of those things I can get in my favor that it's lower or now than it's going to be on average, the more I would like it. And then I do a long-term average of looking at what the price has been and what they might be in the future. I have picked things specifically as cyclicals. Actually wrote up in Singular Diligence, both Progressive and Frost were choices because of cyclicality. Insurance, a lot of times people don't think of that as a cyclical thing, but it's very important, the cyclical aspect of it. And so getting in at a point in which it looks really bad in the industry is often a good point to get in terms of underwriting and stuff. You actually often want to buy, I would love to buy a great insurance company that I believe has the right culture and everything when it writes at the first time ever at 102 combined ratio and it's really averaged 89 or something in the past. That's when I want to buy it because that's when everyone else will think, well, maybe this is, the things have turned and it's not as good and all of that kind of stuff. So I'd love to buy the best underwriter at a time that's bad for them and for everyone else in that industry or something. Those were low return on assets at the time. In the case of both Progressive and Frost, they were exposed to short-term interest rates, right? They had a lot of money sitting idle, basically, and equivalent of like owning T-bills or and stuff. So something where the price is really weak and stuff. But what is that right now? I mean, there are examples. Gas is cheap right now, right? I don't know
natural
what the
gas
price is today.
Yeah, natural gas
is cheap. Oil is not cheap, by my calculation. I'd say oil is fairly normally priced. It's hard to know because we're pricing it. You price in different currencies. You price in whatever. I mean, there's no exact science to it. But if you told me that oil cost, you know, per barrel, that it was anywhere in the range of, let's say, $55 to $85 a barrel or something, or $60 to $90 or something, that, you know, I wouldn't say that any of those would shock me, given, you know, what has happened with inflation since COVID and stuff and adjusting past prices for it. That sounds like fairly reasonable longer term. It might be unreasonable short term if people know a lot about what new supply can be brought on and how low a price, but that stuff doesn't last all that long usually, you know. So that's more what people are interested in, is what's the prediction for the next few years. But if you're looking really long term, you'll burn through a lot of that. You know, a lot of the really affordable new supply that you can put on, it goes away pretty fast. So, and then, you know, there. So I think cyclical things, for bankruptcy things, I guess cyclical things would be okay, possibly. A big thing with bankruptcy things, though, is the management stuff, and if management changes as part of it, or if management was pursuing things that were fine before the bankruptcy and everything. And so that's a very big part of the calculation, and where they're headed in the future with it. So if they're going to take high-risk stuff. The other thing is, as part of a bigger portfolio, you know, it's okay to have some higher-risk things, some things that could do badly, if you're mixing it up with other stuff. I've never said that if I had enough ideas, I wouldn't be against putting in some things that have very high possible payoffs and have some risk of losses and not doing that well and everything.
What are some situations like that could really juice the returns? Can you give us an example of things that you'd be willing to add?
Well, I mean, I've written about some of the things I wrote up A-Mark Precious Metals, right?
Yeah.
Encore Wire, leaders in a field in which you don't really make money unless there's a market failure or tight supply or however you want to put it. You know, those sorts of things. The oil stuff, the complication with the oil stuff is what we've invested in mainly in stuff that has to do with fossil fuels is things in which we don't think that they're going to, mostly in things where we don't think they're going to use a lot of the money, retain most of it to buy additional assets at prevailing prices over time, all the time, as opposed to things that are taking money out, paying them out in dividends, or doing other things that make sense that way, so that you're buying an asset and then taking it more as like a royalty. Actually, publicly traded royalties tend to be really expensive and stuff, but so that my problem with most things in like oil and stuff is like you need the Buffett thing where you have a lot of confidence in he that has an Occidental or whatever in the capital allocation, because if you don't, then you're not as exposed to the underlying commodity and the assets that you think you're buying cheap as much as you're exposed to the capital allocation that's going to happen from management, which could hurt it, you know, as they, you know, it can. It doesn't always, but it certainly can. Gold is a big example of that. You know, I can't think of a lot of examples of things where I would say, even if I thought gold was cheap and the gold miner was cheap, I'm pretty sure they're going to do things in terms of capital allocation that I don't like with almost any gold miner that I've looked at.
Why is that?
Well, they're going to manage as much assets as they can in that industry, in that narrow industry, no matter what. And that tends to be a group of people who are pretty obsessed with that particular thing, and don't think much broader than that, and don't think in terms of a lot of different approaches to how to run it. In natural gas and oil stuff, there is some differences more. I mentioned CNX Resources, right? before because we were talking about it because of Contora and all that we talked about and what those became. But that's a company that hedges stuff and that has a whole different approach, buying back a lot of stock and stuff. Whether it's good or bad, it's a totally different capital allocation approach. We talked about Vitesse that pays it out in dividends and has a lot of undeveloped properties and stuff. And it also owns interests that are different than how most companies operate. So there are differences in terms of how capital allocators behave. And I don't know. I feel like there's less of that in gold things, but I feel like there's less of that in, you know, our area of things, publicly traded money management stuff and all that. They all seem to overall just want to manage a lot more assets and stick to their particular area that they're in. And I feel that way about gold things a lot, but I could be missing things with gold where there's great gold miners in terms of capital allocation I just don't know about.
Mm-hmm. What are some, I mean, give us an example. So a company, they say that they're going to go into Chapter 11. You probably want to understand what put them there. Is this an industry downturn? Were they just, clearly they had a ton of debt, probably, which put them there. It's hard to go bankrupt if you don't have debt. From there, I mean, what are you sort of thinking? Take us through your mosaic so people can, you know, start to think through these things. What would you be interested in?
Well, I mean, the first thing I'd be thinking about is in terms of like enterprise value, what would the overall thing be worth? Remember, for everyone listening to this, in general, any stock is going to be worthless. Now, there are exceptions to this, and those might be the best cases to invest in because the more it looked not like other bankruptcy things, the more attractive it could be because people have a tendency when they see any of these things, the same with if we're talking about a particular bank, particular insurer, whatever, people have a tendency to immediately think that it's like all the other situations they've seen. And so they quickly start thinking that way. So you'll have a lot of people invest in bankruptcy things. They're going to think in terms of what other bankruptcies have looked like. But overall, we have to say, you know, there's with the meme stocks and all that, there's been things that go up and the stock has value even when it's approaching bankruptcy. And normally the common stock is wiped out completely in a bankruptcy situation.
Mm-hmm.
And then you won't really get an opportunity for you listening to this podcast generally to invest until after it emerges from bankruptcy. So really you're reading about all this stuff to have an idea when it comes out emerging from bankruptcy and there's new publicly traded stock. And that's what you would be investing in. Obviously, most bankruptcy investors are buying debt at big discounts to where it was issued originally. And they're doing that, but there's all sorts of reasons why in the United States and stuff, I think it's just not likely that individual investors are going to buy that stuff, be able to buy that stuff. So
interesting. And then afterwards, so you emerge from bankruptcy and depending how it was structured, your debt could get equitized, right? So the debt could get wiped out.
And they'll be the ones selling to you now. Yeah. They want to get out at some point and they'll sell to you. And so you're basically buying from people who had held debt or had been an investor at the last stages of the bankruptcy and stuff like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then what? It's just management executing.
Well,
capital allocation going forward.
So usually there's a lag, and this is the inefficiency part of it. In terms of how it's going to change, it's kind of like a busted growth stock or something. There's going to be a lag where it changes from who's investing in it. So in the early stages, it's people who know a ton about bankruptcy stuff, and they're the ones that you'll be buying from when you buy the new common stock, but they don't necessarily know a ton about the industry or the company or something. What they tend to be very expert in is what's the enterprise value on it? How does that compare to the multiples on other stocks? How does it compare to other things that have come out of bankruptcy? How does the bankruptcy process work? And comping it off of other things, almost like M&A type stuff. They have like a really good knowledge of all that, but they probably haven't looked very carefully at the company and owning it longer term and everything. And then this is your opportunity to buy it if it is something that's a higher quality business or whatever, or you know that industry well. But in my experience, it could take a year or more for there to be clean financials and for management to be communicative and doing new investor relations as if they are a public company that's for the general public to invest in and everything. And so it can be take a really long time. The stuff's all messy. Lots of computers invest instead of people nowadays. So they aren't reading the filings. Instead, they're going off of all that stuff. And so you've heard me say that kind of stuff before, whether it was, you know, someone had asked about NACO last year or something. And I said, like, you know, we own it and stuff. But if you want to wait 6 to 9 months, I'd be surprised if the market incorporates stuff about the future before then, because it's not a very efficiently like looked at stock and stuff. So, you know, I would say that about bankruptcy things generally. there's a lot of like not very impressive write-ups about it and everything, because it's a lot of work to look through it all and to try to kind of figure out what it will look like afterwards. I think the most efficiently priced ones are ones that have very, very clear comps. So they're a group and they can look and they can say, okay, so this is priced this way versus this other, say it's all tankers or something, right? Like it's priced this way versus all these other ones in the exact same industry. I think that unique features of the stock in bankruptcy, of the company in bankruptcy, that make it more niche or whatever is more likely to lead to inefficient pricing. Because the part where people lack a lot of knowledge about it or a lot of care about it, I think, is in understanding the business, the management, the plans for the future and everything, as opposed to a shorter term outlook. What is the asset worth? What's the industry like? What's going to be the next 12 to 18 months or something? That's what generally is very efficiently priced. I think what's less efficiently priced usually is what will this actually be priced at when people forget it was in bankruptcy years from now, right? So like, you know, 3 years down the road, when you pull up QuickFS and everything and it looks normal and management is putting out normal presentations and everything and everyone's forgotten, they're not telling you that we went bankrupt a few years ago. What does it look like now in terms of how do people price it? So that's your probably best opportunity there, is in of using your skills versus other people's, because you're not gonna be an expert on the bankruptcy process. You're not gonna be an expert in having the most things to comp it against and all that. There's professionals who will be much better at all that than you. What professionals might not spend a lot of time on is really evaluating the business as a business. You could look at the long ago past in terms of where the stock traded, you know, what the business was like, all of that. But a bunch of things are kind of messy, because a bunch of things that go into bankruptcy actually do a lot of stuff before they head into bankruptcy. So like their roll-ups that go into bankruptcy and everything, and there's just not a good stable state to look at of what it looked like, you know? So, you know, a typical one that we talked about would be like, right on the website we had Entercom, right? The radio company, which was, you know, a big takeover. It really was a minnow swallowing a whale in terms of radio assets with CBS radio and stuff. There's a, you know, other things that have gotten in trouble sometimes are doing the same sort of things with the roll-ups, which makes it very difficult to analyze what it would look like before. So the business you're seeing is almost like an IPO, that this business doesn't have a past history. You can look at what it traded at and everything.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well said. Well said. Well, the book, if anyone wants to follow along, maybe we'll do another podcast on it, Bankruptcy Investing, How to Profit from Distressed Companies by Ben Branch and Hugh Ray. I have the fourth edition on Amazon. So definitely get that book if you want to learn more about that. Bill Ackman had recommended it on the Lex Friedman podcast. I want to thank everybody so much for tuning in with Jeff and I on the Focus Compounding podcast. If this is the first time you're joining us, be sure to check out all of our content that we push out into the investing universe. If you want to learn more about our money management services, you can reach out to me at andrew@focusedcompounding.com. I want to thank everybody so much for all the support, and we will see you in the next podcast. Take care.